Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Ordell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 8. Seaton and Crane spent some time in developing the object compass. They made several of them, mounted in gimbals on super shock-proof jeweled bearings. Strictly according to Seaton's theory, the instruments were of extreme sensitivity, the one set on the smallest object at the greatest distance. A tiny glass bead at 3,000 miles, registering a true line in less than 1 second. Having solved the problem of navigation, they made up graduated series of explosive bullets, each one matching perfectly its standard .45 caliber counterpart. They placed their blueprints and working notes in the safe as usual, taking with them only those dealing with the object compass and the explosive bullet, on which they were still working. They cautioned Shiro and the three guards to watch everything closely until they got back. Then they set out in the helicopter to try out the new weapon in place where the explosions could do no damage. It came fully up to expectations. A Mark I charge fired by Crane at a stump over 100 yards from the flat-top knoll that had afforded them a landing place tore it bodily from the ground and reduced it to splinters. The force of the explosion made the two men stagger. "Wow!" Seaton exclaimed. "Wonder what a Mark V will do."
"Careful, Dick. What are you going to shoot at?"
"Oh, that rock across the valley. Range finders says 900 yards. Bet me a buck I can't hit it."
"The pistol champion of the district, hardly."
The pistol cracked, and when the bullet reached its destination, the boulder was obliterated in a vast ball of something. It was not exactly nor all flame. It had none of the searing, killing, unbearable radiance of an atomic bomb. It did not look much, if any, hotter than the sphere of primary action of a massive charge of high explosive. It did not look even remotely like anything either man had ever seen before. Their observations were interrupted by the arrival of the shockwave. They were hurled violently backward, stumbling and falling flat. When they could again keep their feet, both stared silently at the tremendous mushroom-shaped cloud, which was hurling itself upward at an appalling pace and spreading itself outward almost as fast. Crane examined Geiger and scintillometer, reporting that both had continued to register only background radiation throughout the test. Seaton made observations and used his slide rule. "Can't do much from here right under it, but the probable minimum is 97,000 feet and it's still boiling upward. I will be totally jiggered." Both men stood for minutes, awed into silence by the incredible forces they had loosed. Then Seaton made the understatement of his long life. "I don't think I'll shoot a Mark 10 around here."
"Haven't you done anything yet?" Brookings demanded.
"I can't help it, Mr. Brookings," Perkins replied. "Prescott's men are hard to do business with."
"I know that, but surely one of them can be reached."
"Not at 10, that was your limit. 25 or no dice."
Brookings drummed fingers on a desk.
"Well, if we have to," and wrote out an order on the cashier for $25,000 in small to medium bills. "I'll see you at the cafe tomorrow at 4 o'clock.
The place referred to was the Perkins Cafe, a restaurant on Pennsylvania Avenue. It was the favorite eating place of the diplomatic, political, financial, and social elite of Washington, none of whom even suspected that it had been designed and was being maintained by the world-girdling World Steel Corporation as the hub and center of its world-girdling nefarious activities. At 4 o'clock of the following day, Brookings was ushered into Perkins' private office. "Blessed it, Perkins, can't you do anything?" he demanded. "It just couldn't be helped," Perkins replied doggedly. "Everything was figured to the second, but the Jap smelled a rat or something and jumped us. I managed to get away, but he laid Tony out cold. But don't worry. I sent Silk Humphrey and a couple of the boys out to get him. Told him to report at 4:08. Any second now." In less than a minute, Perkins' communicator buzzed. "This is the Dick, not Silk," it said in its tiny, tinny voice. "He's dead. So are the two goons. That Jap, he's chain lightning on grease wheels. Got all three of them. Anything else I can do for you?" "No, your job's done." Perkins closed the switch, fusing the spy's communicator into a blob of metal, and Brookings called to Quesney. "Can you come to my office, or are you bugged?" "Yes to both, a bug from stem to gudgeon. Prescott men in front, back, on the sides, and up in the trees. I'll be right over." "But wait." "Relax. You think they can outsmart me? I know more about bugging and debugging than Prescott and his dicks will ever learn." In Brookings' office, Duquesne told, with saturnine amusement, of the devices he had rigged to misinform the private eyes. He listened to Brookings' recital of failure. Then he said, "I knew you'd louse it up, so I've been making some plans of my own. One thing, though, I want limpidly clear. From now on, I give the orders, right?"
"Right.
Get me a helicopter just like Crane's. Get a hophead 6 feet tall that weighs about 160 pounds. Give him a 3-hour jolt. Have him at the field 2 hours from now."
"Can do."
Duquesne was at the field on time. So were the flying machine and the unconscious man. Both were exactly what he had ordered. He took off, climbed swiftly, made a wide circle to the west and north. Shiro and the two guards, hearing the roar of engines, looked up and saw what they supposed to be Crane's helicopter coming down in a vertical drop. Slowing at the last possible second, it taxied up the field toward them. A man, recognizable as Seaton by his suit and physique, stood up, shouted hoarsely, pointed to the lean, still form beside him, beckoned frantically with both arms, and then slumped down completely inert. All three rushed up to help. There were three silenced reports, and three men dropped. Duquesne leapt lightly out of the copter and scanned the three bodies. The two guards were dead, but Shiro, to his chagrin, showed faint signs of life, but very faint. He wouldn't live long. He put on gloves, went into the house, blew the safe, and rifled it. He found the vial of solution, but could find neither the larger bottle nor any reference to it. He then searched the house from attic to basement. He found the vault, carefully concealed though its steel door was, but even he could do nothing about that. Nor was there any need, he decided, as he stood staring at it, the only change in his expression being a slight narrowing of the eyes and concentrated thought. The bulk of that solution was probably in the heaviest, deepest, safest vault in the country. He returned to the helicopter. In a short time, he was back in his own room, poring over blueprints and notebooks. Coming in the dusk, Crane and Seaton both began to worry when they saw that their landing lights were not burning. They made a bumpy landing and hurried toward the house. They heard a faint moan and turned, Seaton whipping out his flashlight with one hand and his automatic with the other. He hastily replaced the weapon and bent over Shiro, a touch having assured him that the other two were beyond help. They picked up Shiro and carried him into his own room, while Seaton applied first-aid treatment to the ghastly wound in Shiro's head. Crane called a surgeon, the coroner, the police, and finally Prescott, with whom he held a long conversation. Having done all they could for the injured man, they stood by his bedside, their anger all the more deadly for being silent. Seaton stood with every muscle tense. His right hand, white-knuckled, gripped the butt of his pistol, while under his left the heavy brass rail of the bed began slowly to bend. Crane stood impassive, but with his face white and every feature hard as marble. Seaton was the first to speak.
"Mart," he gritted, husky with fury, "a man who could leave another man dying like that ain't a man at all. He's a thing. I'll shoot him with the biggest charge we've got. No, I won't either. I'll take him apart with my bare hands."
"We'll find him, Dick." Crane's voice was low, level, and deadly. "That is one thing money can do." The tension was relieved by the arrival of the surgeon and his nurses, who set to work with the deftness and precision of their highly specialized crafts. After a time, the doctor turned to Crane.
"Merely a scalp wound, Mr. Crane. He should be up in a few days."
The police, Prescott, and the coroner arrived in that order. There was a great deal of bustling and stirring about and investigating, some of which was profitable. There were many guesses and a few sound deductions. And Crane offered a reward of $1 million tax-paid dollars for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the murderer. Please join me next time for more danger and intrigue in The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. In the meantime, watch the skies.
Thank you.